So, Elaine, you're choosing option two. You're going to both extend the downwind and join final extra high to be above the wake. But aren't those two things working cross purposes with each other? The further you extend the downwind, the higher you're going to have to be because this jet has been on a long 3-degree path all the way into the airport. How far out are you going to go? How high are you going to go? And how are you going to know that that's enough before it's too late?
I think given the situation, avoiding the invisible wake where you're not sure exactly when it's going to be dissipating is something you need to do at all costs, meaning the higher you go, the safer you are. Even if you're at an inappropriately high altitude or a little too far out, you have a very good visual of the ground below and the airport, and so altitude in this case is going to keep you safe. Even if you end up having to go around again because you've turned on final and realize you're too high and too far out, you are talking to tower and they understand that you're in a pickle with the wake turbulence avoidance and they'll resequence you if need be. So I think staying higher, eyeballing where the Airbus is on final, a beam you, is really hard to tell when you're over a congested area. You really don't know that Airbus is at altitude, even though you have them in sight. So just making sure you've got extra altitude, extra distance, and extra time, at least 2 to 3 minutes behind the wake, would be the safest way to go. And even if it's a little too much cushion, so be it. I think altitude is your friend here.
And Catherine is nodding. Catherine also agreed with you with choice two. I don't know if I should read too much into this about the two aerobatic pilots both choosing option two here. But Catherine, I'll sort of pose the same question to you. Do you have any hacks on how you know how much is enough in this situation? How far out, how high?
Let me start off by saying that there are many good advisory circulars out there. 90-23 is not one of them. I'm reading from 90-23 right now that says, an aircraft generates vortices from the moment it rotates on takeoff to touchdown, since trailing vortices are a byproduct of wing lift. That last part is true, but the idea that an airplane is not generating dangerous vortices while it's on the ground is total BS. A number of years ago, I put cones on strings taped to the end of my wingtips and filmed a video that showed that indeed they start when you're still on the ground. That's something that bothered me as a student pilot. And so the idea that you're going to try to imagine where these vortices are, which is most of what 90-23 does. It shows these red vortices and shows where they might be. And I just think trying to imagine where these vortices are is just a losing strategy from the outset. You know, if they were red light like that, it'd be, nice, we could avoid them. But the insidious part is, of course, we don't know exactly where they are. So for me, the reason I chose option two is that I'm going to extend my downwind and it's going to be purely based on time. I'm going to note where that Airbus is at a point on its landing, and I'm going to make sure I'm not at that same point within 2 minutes. The good news here is that there is a bit of wind, so it means that those vortices are probably going to dissipate by more on the order of 2 minutes rather than three. And I think that's the only virtue in 90-23 is the advice that it gives you on waiting between operations. So for me, it's extending downwind purely so that I am at minimum 2 minutes behind, as Elaine pointed out, two to three minutes behind that other aircraft. I'm not going to try to necessarily land long. I'm just going to make it a function of time.
So that makes a lot more sense to me that you're trying to do a temporal separation rather than a physical separation between these two things. And listeners may recognize the setup on this. It is inspired by a real accident that unfortunately resulted in the death of Charlie Schneider, who many of us did know and will certainly be missed, an experienced pilot who got caught by this. And with what information we've been able to piece together, it was not very much time between when those two aircrafts crossed paths. So lacking visualization, you're going with time. Kevin, if I were having to choose, I'm with you on option three, because I don't know how time's going to work out, but I know if I turn towards the runway, boy, I feel like I can definitely do space. I know I can be above it. Is that why you're choosing option three, the definitely being above, or is it something different?
For me, it's about being above the wake. That's the most important part of the whole thing, is reliably staying above the wake turbulence. The reason I don't like the extending the downwind and climbing is, if you were reasonably confident that the airplane you were following was the only one out there, then okay, you know, that might be a possibility. But at a busy airport, there's another one coming. And if you're in a slow piston single on final, probably that's going to cause problems, and there's a good chance you'll go around and have to try it again and be likely put in the exact same scenario again just 5 minutes later. For me, the turn to the threshold, I like to stay above the wake, but I would do it a little bit differently than what probably anybody would consider conventional, in that we're on a left downwind, so the conventional thought is you're in a left-based turn to follow traffic. Tightening it up to point at the threshold in the direction that you're already expected to go could potentially keep you above the wake. But I think if I were in that situation, I would make a steep turn to the right and come around and point at the threshold. And then while in that turn, and I'm fully acknowledging this is a bit unconventional, but painted into a corner a bit here. And then while in the turn, tell tower, hey, I'm in a right turn to avoid the wake from the Airbus, and I'll plan on touching down a little bit long. I do think it's important to tell tower what you're doing so they don't think you're lost or going to the wrong airport or any number of things. But I think if you make a steep turn to the right, that puts you in a more safe position to stay away from the wake of the Airbus on final.
John, you're a former controller. Kevin just made a right turn 360 on the downwind and told you he's making a right turn and going to then be going short approach and long landing.
Right, like 200 degree turn or so.
Yeah. How do you feel about this?
So I would, and if I understand what Kevin's doing, he's not doing a 360. What he's doing is from the base leg, making a turn that shortens the flight path towards the runway. And that would involve a right turn at some point. You turn back towards the runway, then you'd have to make a right turn back to the threshold, which, you know, all of these come down to buying time. You know, Catherine talked a lot about buying time. I think Kevin's idea is the same thing. The tower controller would probably say, what the heck are you doing? You know, this is a fairly unconventional maneuver. If he didn't exactly explain it by communicating correctly, it would certainly give the tower controller pause. And that's kind of what I was thinking also with option one, is I would slow down, climb if necessary. It's all about buying time to let the wake settle and to let the wake dissipate and to get above it. And to put the ATC hat on back again, the thing I wouldn't do would be extend the downwind. I think that's only going to cause a conflict with the next jet. You're probably going to cause a conflict with the next jet just by slowing down or widening out or doing whatever you're doing there. But at least you're ahead of the other plane. If you extend the downwind, the controller is probably going to say, you know, cancel the landing clearance. You're now number three, something like that. You're going to be following another Airbus, and you're going to be following him from 7 miles out now instead of 2 miles out.
Kevin, then Paul.
The other thing that I'd like to reiterate is I'm not so concerned about my distance from the airplane itself. I'm already way closer to the airplane than is going to be safe from a standpoint of if I don't worry about the wake, I'm not going to be 4 miles behind the Airbus at any point. So knowing that I'm going to have to contend with the wake, now I don't care if I'm 1 mile behind that Airbus, as long as I'm really confidently above where the wake is going to be and I'm going to touch down beyond where they touch down.
Paul.
You know, I'll admit to not being the sharpest knife in the drawer here, but I don't understand that maneuver. So let me make sure I got this straight. So if you're in the downwind, you are going to do a right, like 270 to rejoin the base?
Yeah, that's more or less that's what I'm saying, is instead of making a left turn to the base from the downwind, make a right, maybe it wouldn't be a full 270 because I'm pointing at probably just beyond the touchdown zone, or point at the numbers-ish and be high. But yeah, make a right turn and then roll out of that right turn pointed at the numbers.
And you'd let the tower know you're doing that?
Absolutely, while on the turn, because that would be a very unexpected maneuver. So I think it would be important to communicate that you're doing something unexpected. But I also want to make sure that I'm not flying through the wake of that Airbus, because I don't want it to be the end of me.
Paul, both you and Wally, you're a 4/1 and a 4/2. You're going to cross over and try for 10 right. Let me start with you, Paul. What's the thinking there, and how are you going to execute this?
That runway is there. It's available. It's not closed. It's closer to the FBO. And while it's true, I haven't heard anything on the frequency because of the split frequency between the two towers. If I request 10 right for wake separation, I think a controller is going to do all he or she can to make that happen. And so now I'm crossing the wake of the A320 at right angles. It would be good to be above it. If I'm not above it, it's going to be a bump, but it's probably not going to upset the airplane. And of course, you get two shots at it. But if that's approved, then what am I left to do? Well, I'm left to do a frequency change. It's not a big deal. I mean, the tower controllers will coordinate it. The guy working the other runway knows I'm coming. So I get the landing clearance and I don't have to contend with any wake turbulence at all. I don't have to worry about time. I don't have to worry about angle or any of that. And I get a clean runway and I get closer to the FBO. So that would be my thinking. I think it's a doable thing. The controllers in these airports are very capable and they're very cooperative. So it also, to me, demonstrates that you can do this sort of thing. ATC is there to provide a service. They're there to provide safety and separation, and they'll do everything they can to make that work. And this is just an option.
John, what do you think about that?
Incredibly, I agree with Paul. It's not a big deal. You know, the two controllers are standing next to each other. The controller working the left runway would say, hey, can I ship this Bonanza over to, you know, and the guy on the right side is going to say, yeah, something like follow the Cherokee on a 2 mile final and he's yours, or switch him or whatever. But, you know, that's why I opted for the 1/4. I think I would slow down, keep the base leg high, evaluate the situation and say, I don't like this. I want to go over to the other side. And that would be the bailout. It might even involve like overflying the final and making a right downwind then and following somebody. But the other advantage to landing on that right runway is its threshold is displaced more to the east. So you could stay higher longer and you'd be touching down, you know, it would give you more time. So I wouldn't be afraid of the switch to the runway. The approach controller is not sequencing to the runway. They're sequencing IFRs, but they're not sequencing VFRs. So it's really up to the tower. And at these busy places, that's not a big deal.
Wally.
Well, I'm also in favor of one. I'm, as the pilot in command, my first plan is to tell ATC what I need to keep my flight safe. And if they can help me, that's great. If they can't, then we've got to go to plan B. Well, I'm doing that. I'm going to be watching that Airbus and either level off or start to climb if necessary, to put him on the horizon or below the horizon. I don't need to look at my altimeter. I just simply need to know that I'm above him when he's below the horizon. So if ATC can't accommodate me, but if for the reasons John and Paul stated, they probably will, there's a good possibility, then I'm going to continue the base leg turn, staying above that Airbus all the way down, landing long. It's a long runway. I can land as far as I need down there to be comfortable. And we don't have a crosswind. The wind's pretty much down the runway, so hopefully we won't have one vortex blowing from one side to the other. But I think it's pretty easy to do, and at least it's our job as PICs to enlist ATC to help us solve the problem. And then if they can't, then we'll have to work together.
Wally, for clarity here, which do you prefer? Just so I know, are you going to extend the downwind? And if that doesn't work out, try to switch runways? Because I had you down as option 4 and option 1. Or would you rather cross over and land on the right, and then, but also maybe land long over any jets that are over there?
My first choice is to land on 10 right, and okay, that's what I'm going to express. The alternative to that is, in my mind, number 4, I'm just going to level off or get above the Airbus and make my base leg and fly the approach to 10 left high.
Paul.
Okay. This is a question for Kevin and John. What's the etiquette on a long landing? You think a controller has to be asked or hear the request?
Well, it's particularly for a busy airport that's flying a lot of jets, moving a lot of jets in and out. The landing long it's good for a couple of reasons. Number one is the wake that we're obviously talking about. But the other thing that's a consideration at a busy airport is the flow of airplanes on the surface of the airport and the way that they're taxiing. And there's a flow to that at busy airports. And when you land, if you land in your typical GA airplane and you're turning off 1,500 feet from the approach end of the runway, often you're going to be in a bad spot relative to where the departures are taxiing out. And it can introduce a lot of complexity for getting you into the FBO, depending on the airport and the layout, of course. But if you're turning off farther down the runway where the jets are also turning off, then you fit right into the flow for taxiing away from the runway.
Anything to add to that, John?
Sure. Yeah, I agree with that, but you should at least let the controller know what your plan is going to be if it's not obvious in a situation like that. Situation like this where you're landing behind a jet, the runway separation requirements are not going to come into effect. The jet has to be just 6,000 feet down or clear. Where it might come into effect is if you're landing multiple singles 3,000 feet apart. Which can happen in some of these busy Florida airports with a lot of flight training. So if they're planning on you landing on the numbers because they've got somebody else 3,000 feet down the runway in a rollout, and you decide to land long on top of them, that could be an issue. So it is somewhat situational, which is why it's always good to let the controller know.
I have the pleasure of not one, but two aerobatic instructors at the table here. So I'm going to ask you both, do you teach upset recovery for pilots? And if you do, how do you teach them? Because this isn't something that they're going to go out on the next Saturday and be able to practice on their own. You're teaching in aerobatic capable airplanes, you know, the 152 Aerobat and aerobatic Bonanza and a Citabria, in your case, Elaine. And I'd kind of like to hear from both of you. Let me start with Elaine.
Sure. And I'll just preface this by saying that knowing how to fly an airplane from inverted to upright, like an upset recovery scenario, did not come into play in this. This is the aircraft, and this is the situation, and this is what needs to be done. So just to preface that might have been just a coincidence to that. But as far as the instruction, there are any number of scenarios that could cause an upset, whether it's past a roll level that a pilot has any experience with, to all the way around inverted and back the way around. So we just kind of count on understanding scenarios, looking at accident reports, and saying these are things that have actually happened. And if you're kind of in the program where you want to get some experience with that, sure, then that becomes part of the discussion.
Staying with you for a second, Elaine, are there any like things that you dial in for people, you know, sort of like an ABC kind of thing or something, or is it really just the experience of being in a truly unusual attitude and realizing that the controls still work. We can still deal with this.
Sure. And a lot of it starts with just a lot of discussion on how the controls actually work, again, in attitudes that the pilot may not have experienced, and getting a good discussion on understanding first how it works before you get into the airplane and actually do it, because that's, I think that's just part of the educational process. And then you go do it. And depending on, right, that can be regardless of the upset scenario that you're discussing, or even if it's just aerobatic maneuvers in and of themselves, because those also involve contingency planning, where you need to plan for something unplanned happening even during a planned maneuver. So it all comes into play.
Catherine, you're the heir to Bill Kirshner's school, and this is the center of your wheelhouse. A pilot just needs to take away from this simple, direct, like, if all this planning to avoid the wake doesn't work out and you still mess up, what do you do? What do you
right.
do?
Right. So when I teach aerobatics, we do upset maneuver training. And we obviously brief it well on the ground. And when we're in the air, I teach my students to first of all push forward on the yoke. It'll help you maintain better control of the aircraft. If you're in an uncommanded role, I need you to push and try to beat it. And if you can't beat it, join it. So continue that role in the direction that the aircraft is rolling. Whatever you do, do not pull, because when pilots are in unusual situations, in a lot of cases they have the tendency to pull, and you need to resist that, push, and like I say, if you can't beat it, join it. We do practice these when we do aerobatics, but in all honesty, it's probably one of the least realistic emergencies that we can practice. So no matter how great an aerobatic pilot you are, if you're low to the ground, this may not end well. So your best bet is to try to avoid this situation, and which is why I'm so big on making sure that there is sufficient time between these craft operations.
I also have the pleasure of two ATC professionals at the table here. From the air traffic controller perspective, how much does the controller think about, in a VFR situation, the danger to the smaller aircraft? Sure, there is the caution wake turbulence, but how much is the controller factoring that in versus leaving it up to the pilot to sort that out? Kevin?
I think that a lot of controllers more think about it in terms of separation responsibility and what separation needs to be applied and how it's applied, rather than some depth of thought of exactly what a pilot might need to do to keep themselves safe. In this case, where you have a small aircraft being sequenced behind a large, the responsibility for wake turbulence separation is on ATC right up until the point that the pilot reports the airplane in sight and is going to follow them visually. And then at that point, the responsibility for the wake turbulence separation falls on the pilot, and the controller still wants to keep airplanes moving. So they figure pilots are going to do their pilot stuff and do what they need to land without really getting into the nuances of what is necessary that way. They probably would expect that landing a little bit long and touching down beyond the normal touchdown point, that would be a normal thing for somebody in a debonair to do behind an Airbus 320.
John, do you have anything to add to that?
No. What Kevin said, because there's such a wide experience and knowledge of actual aircraft operations across the controller workforce, really all they're concerned about is whatever the book standards are for wake turbulence separation and the appropriate phraseology to use at that point. I mean, if you ask most controllers, they would say it's an Airbus 320, it's not a 757, it's not a heavy. They just treat it like any other jet. And as Kevin said, they're going to leave it up to the pilot to do your pilot stuff and do whatever you got to do. What is interesting, if I can do a little sidebar on this, is the Airbus 320 family seems to be particularly prone to generating a lot of wake. They're not just your average jet, and I'm not sure if it's the winglets. They have a bunch of different varieties of them. NASA came out with an ASRS study, which I just read, and they documented about 30 some odd wake turbulence events, and more than 50% of them were Airbus 320s with the lead aircraft. And this was like 767s following an Airbus. I mean, it was large airplanes encountering some pretty severe wake turbulence. So that in and of itself might be a red flag for some people. Say, if you're following a 320, it may be more than just your average jet.
Has anyone here around the round table been caught in a frightening wake? I mean, we all probably hit a bump here or two or there. I can say that probably one of the closest times I came to dying in an airplane was a wake encounter close to the ground from a DC-8, which tells you it was a cargo DC-8, but it tells you how old I am. But has anyone else had that visceral experience of being seriously rolled? Not a one. And so the follow-up question on that is, how much do you think about it? I mean, it's all theoretical until it really happens. And I'll tell you, it's terrifying when it happens. Elaine.
Sure. Elaine. This has not happened to me. And I think when we're at a Class C airport, I fly into places like Madison, Wisconsin, a lot, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where the tower is always saying caution, wake turbulence. So you hear that term a lot. But I think because nothing has ever happened in those times when I'm landing behind a large aircraft, it's and usually I'm with students or other pilots, I think it tends to make us a little complacent because it seems like they're always warning you about the wake turbulence, but yet nothing happens. And I think a lot of it has to do with, in the back of your mind, you are aware, okay, let a couple minutes go by, or okay, there's enough of a crosswind where you feel the wake turbulence will not be an issue. But I think it's really a good topic to bring up because I think people do get complacent because they maybe don't take the warning seriously from ATC, and they may have forgotten that you need to have, depending on the pilot's choice, time followed by altitude or some position of your flight path above the wake. And I think it's really good to review that occasionally.
Kevin.
Just to build on what she was just saying, there are certain situations where controllers are required to say caution, wake turbulence. However, there's not a prohibition on saying it when it doesn't make sense at all. And I agree with her that there's a lot of times that as a pilot flying around, but also knowing what the ATC rules are, there's been more than a few times where I've heard the caution, wake turbulence call where I know that number one, it definitely isn't required by the book. And also it really isn't a practical concern at all. Like I'm departing behind a Citation Mustang or something that's very small and I'm really not worried about it at all, and nor should I be. Yeah, I do think there's a certain element of boy who cried wolf type of situation here, but the reality is that's the world that we live in, and we have to deal with that and know that sometimes it is a real danger.
Catherine.
I wrote an article for my column in Pilot Magazine a few years ago that was related to the video to which I referred earlier on wingtip vortices and visualizing those. A few months later, even though I haven't had a personal experience near an airport hitting wake, our friend and colleague Tom Haynes did. So he reported that even though he landed, I think, long, that he still got a wallop near the ground. And he, in his column for Pilot Magazine, several months after my article came out, he amplified the message from my article. And I was grateful for him sharing that personal experience. So again, I'll just vote for the time between operations.
Yeah. And Catherine, while I have you, do you ask this question on your practical exams? You're a DPE, you do a lot of exams. Do you cover wake turbulence and wake turbulence avoidance?
Absolutely. That's one of the scenarios that I do present on some practical exams.
And you, Wally, was it something you regularly did sometimes, or with so much that has to be covered on these exams, was that a priority?
No, it's required to cover it on at least private pilot exams and commercial pilot exams. I'd have to check on the others, but it's, yeah, I covered it as Catherine did.
Did this pilot make a mistake even trying going into Fort Lauderdale? I mean, they wanted to expand their comfort envelope and go in, but, you know, is this, given how insidious a wake can be and how non-standard things are going to have to happen, potentially like a long landing or crossing over at the last minute, was it a bad choice to go into Fort Lauderdale? Kevin's saying no. Catherine's also saying no. Kevin.
No, I don't think it's a bad choice at all. And I say that as somebody that flies small airplanes into big, busy airports routinely. I do think that it requires preparation. It's part of flight planning that you got to think about regardless of which airport you're going into. Not different than if you're going into a short field and you got to think about the considerations there. If you're going into a big, busy airport that's going to have a lot of heavy iron flying in and out, you ought to have that thought process of what you plan to do to avoid wake turbulence and how you want to keep yourself safe.
Catherine.
You referenced my mentor earlier, Bill Kirshner. One of his favorite expressions was to say that the most dangerous pilots in the world were the ones who never banked more than 30 degrees. And analogous to that, I think that pilots should always, in some safe way, be expanding their envelope. So I think absolutely the pilot should go ahead and take this on, but with adequate preparation.
You know, it's funny, I think about the saying, there's nothing more useless than runway behind you or altitude above you. But here we've got an exception, if you will. Sometimes it is kind of useful to have the runway behind you, where the dangerous vortices are. And that PIC authority, you know, to like tighten your PIC belt and say, they're busy, they're trying to fit me in, but this is my airplane, this is my life, and I am going to ask for what I need and not accept things that I'm not comfortable with.